These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. This was a huge week in New Hampshire politics. The dramatic end to the Democratic presidential primary, massive crowds for a visit from the president himself, and a flood of national media and political activists entering and then exiting the Granite State. But meanwhile, there was a lot of other news this week, especially at our state house. Governor Sununu gave his State of the State address. Hundreds of bills are making their way through the legislature, and local officials are advocating for more funding to tackle water contamination that has affected so many communities. Today in The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, the What Else Was Going On edition. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always comment on Facebook or tweet us, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Dean, great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Laura.
And also with us, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count. Anna, thank you very much.
Good morning.
And also with us, Ethan DeWitt, Statehouse reporter for the Concord Monitor. And Ethan, thank you for taking time out.
I'll be back.
So all of you, Governor Sununu addressed a joint session of lawmakers at the Statehouse yesterday, as you know, with a long list of what he considers to be his accomplishments. And as you guys know, it's typical for governors to use these occasions to say, hey, folks, this state of the state is very good. So let's just get a little flavor of what the governor said.
In just the last year, study after study across this country, New Hampshire has been recognized on a national level for an unparalleled quality of life. We're the number one state in the country for economic freedom. We are the number one state for the lowest poverty rate in the country. We are the number one state for the taxpayer return on investment and the number one state for opportunity.
So again, that's the governor at the Statehouse yesterday giving his State of the State address. Anna, to you first, what struck you about this speech?
It was definitely a lot more friendly than last year's speech in terms of how he was speaking about bipartisanship and speaking to Democrats and people on the other side of the aisle. So last year, he called out a couple bills in particular and said, this is a terrible idea. Let's not do it. This year, he focused on programs that pretty much both sides can buy into at this point. The sort of jabs at the Democratic Party were very low key. You know, he didn't mention the fact that he has testified in favor of bills that are sponsored by Democrats this year. He didn't mention that he has vetoed some bills that had bipartisan sponsorship from Democrats and Republicans. So, but, you know, overall, he was basically cheerleading New Hampshire. Positive message.
What jumped out at you, Dean?
A couple of different things. I think what struck me right off the bat was the economic focus at the top of the speech. He mentioned multiple times in the first couple of minutes the phrase low business taxes, and basically this idea that low business taxes are what create economic opportunity and prosperity in the state, higher wages, et cetera, not actions by the state legislature. And this is for me. This has been at the core of the disagreements between the governor and the Democrats in the state legislature. The governor believes that you use revenue policy to spur business development and economic prosperity. Democrats are more focused on the legislature directing funds and programs in particular ways, also the minimum wage, family medical leave being mandatory, et cetera. So for me, I was not surprised to see right at the top of the speech an intensive focus on the business climate, on his philosophy of how you create prosperity. And that really has been at the core of most of the big disagreements with Democrats in Congress, in the legislature. And I think that's going to continue into the November election for sure. You know, a couple of other things. It was a shorter speech. It was kind of retrospective rather than prospective. He didn't use it as an opportunity to launch a new agenda for reelection. The elephant in the room, obviously, no mention of the 57 vetoes. And as we've heard from Democrats since the speech, there is this subtext of We're willing to work with the governor, but he doesn't talk to us very much. We don't really know what he wants, and then we get hit with these vetoes down the road. So
I definitely want to hear about those vetoes.
And then the very last thing I would say is that he touched on a suite of issues dealing with the family medical leave, prescription drugs, assisted living, addiction, mental health. Issues that I've seen increasingly take center stage in New Hampshire over the last 10 years.
Well, and we'll definitely talk about those vetoes because guilty as charged, I have been so focused on the primary that I'm thinking 57 vetoes. Wow,
that's
I haven't heard very
lot.
Much about that.
Yeah,
so we'll definitely talk about that. But just broadly, Ethan DeWitt, what jumped out at you from this speech?
Well, just picking up from what Anna said, I think that the tone was very different. When he came in, this was obviously a change politically for him last year in terms of control of the legislature. And he took it as there was a lot of uncertainty over how the year would play out. And it was also a budget year where there were a lot of big decisions. And he took it as an opportunity to sort of use the bully pulpit to lay out his vision for how taxes should be. He talked about how there's already hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxes being proposed by Democrats. He had a very kind of sharp tone to it. I think a year later, we've seen a lot of partisan rancor. We've seen 57 vetoes, but we also have a sense of kind of we know where everything's heading. And I don't know if that's what informed the decision to take a much more kind of cooperative and subdued tone, which I thought I noticed yesterday. But there is a sense that a lot of the bills that were vetoed last year are coming back. And, a lot of the same fights are kind of foretold at this point. And so perhaps it wasn't seen as necessarily beneficial to drum those up so early on in the session when we're likely to get a slew of vetoes at the end of the session and heading right into an election.
That fits into what I was saying earlier. I mean, my question is all the legislating that we're seeing from Democrats very quickly on the big issues like minimum wage and family medical leave, are those being done strategically to set up for the battle in November? Or do you think there really is an interest in between Governor Sununu and the Democratic legislature in getting something done? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's a big question, watching how quickly the legislature is moving on these core issues.
Yeah, so there are certainly a lot of areas of compromise where the governor and state house leaders are working together. One of them is prescription drugs. We can talk about that later. But I think one of the big themes that you see in this election year with Sununu is that he vetoed a lot of Democratic priorities. So, Democrats came into the state house last year, first time they'd taken back both chambers in a while, and they set out their agenda, and a lot of their agenda was vetoed in the summer. But in a lot of those priorities, I'm thinking of net metering and paid family leave, for instance, the governor has recognized, he says he's recognized the value of them, he just sees a different approach. And so he's now proposed alternatives on a number of fronts to the Democratic bills he vetoed. And he's used Republican sponsors to introduce them this year. And so what we're having now this year is kind of a parallel mirror, push for these issues. And what'll be interesting to see is whether this is in earnest or not, and whether both sides actually want these or just want to say they produce something and then talk past each other.
Sure. And that's really interesting. And I was struck, like all of you, by the bipartisan tone. I wasn't sure what the tone would actually be, given that it is an election year, although I kind of don't want to talk about anything election related right now. But yes, there will be elections in the fall of this year for governor and state house and U.S. House and so forth. Let's hear a little bit of that tone again from the governor. Here he is talking about last year's budget. And the budget is always tough. But last year it was especially tough. It ended with a bipartisan compromise. But that was just before a 3-month temporary spending agreement was set to expire. So they kind of did what the feds sometimes do. They went into one of these continuing resolutions. But here's Sununu talking about it, sounding like, hey, everybody came together. It was great.
Members of both parties came together, worked out a compromise that everyone could truly be proud of. The budget was a big win for New Hampshire families because we held the line on taxes. We returned cash to cities and towns for property tax relief, and we provided historic event investments into our education system. The budget didn't make financial promises that could not be kept, and that's something that the people in New Hampshire should be very, very proud of.
So Dean Spiliotis, Governor Sununu, is running for a third term. So do you hear any hints of an election strategy there?
Well, I mean, it was going back to my comments at the beginning of the show. It didn't feel like he used it as a forceful platform to set up a re-election bid. We'll see. We know it's going to be a very polarizing and toxic electoral environment in the fall. The question for me is going to be whether or not Sununu is going to fall in line with other Republicans behind President Trump and become part of that whole set of arguments? Or is he going to try to do what New Hampshire governors often do, which is kind of step to the side a little bit and say, I'm mainly focused on what's good for New Hampshire. I'm interested in bipartisan compromise, et cetera, et cetera. I'm still on the fence about which way he's going to go. He's actually been pretty effective in general at doing a little bit of each. And kind of triangulating between those two positions. He'll probably do some more of that. You look at a lot of the language coming from Democrats out of the state legislature. They have not minced words about how they feel about those 57 vetoes. And I think there's a reason why this was more retrospective than anything else. I think we haven't really we're sort of inching towards what I think is going to be a very for all the suggestions that he's willing to work with the state legislature. I think, as we get closer to the summer and the fall, it's going to be increasingly difficult.
What did you hear from Democrats yesterday, Anna?
Well, I think that they were pointing out that, okay, so he took a very bipartisan tone in this speech, and it was a very friendly speech, but where does the rubber hit the road? Right. This is already just a little before that speech, he had vetoed a net metering bill that was bipartisan sponsorship. And we also, yesterday during the speech, NHPR, I was in the room here, and we were talking to Rep. Doug Lay, the majority leader in the House, and he was saying, we're right down the hall. When's the governor going to come talk to us?
And I think the problems they're going to have negotiating family medical leave are going to be indicative of all the other problems that they're going to have. That really has been kind of the flagship of the difficulty between the two sides. And I think that's going to continue. I don't know how they're going to agree on something there.
Well, and again, we invite your calls about net metering, family leave, some of these other issues that we're going to tackle in a few minutes for sure. You can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can use Facebook or Twitter. Once again, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. On the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, we're talking about the governor's State of the State speech right now. And in a few minutes, we will look at some of the bills before the legislature, including these 57 vetoes that our guests are talking about. And again, we welcome your comments and questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Anna, since you mentioned Doug Lay, again, he's a Democrat from Jaffrey. He's the majority leader. He spoke to us yesterday on our coverage, hosted by my colleague Peter Biello. Let's hear what Majority Leader Lay says about this call for cooperation.
Well, it was less of a partisan call for bipartisanship as opposed to last year, which was highly partisan. This time, the governor, seems to be calling for a greater degree of cooperation. But I think, we're a bit skeptical yet. Actions generally speak louder than words. That's what I was always taught. And with 57 vetoes last year and very little input ever from the governor on any legislation, we still await to see what the governor actually intends to do.
A partisan call for bipartisanship. I had to listen to that a couple times this morning, and I thought, what does that mean? Ethan, how do you sort of untangle that?
Yeah, so we're kind of in a calm before the storm, and I think that bringing up the budget is an interesting point because I think in this political environment, especially down in Washington, political attention spans are very short, and so when something like a shutdown happened 20 years ago in Washington, that was a big deal. These days, a shutdown happens and voters barely remember it 3 months later, and I think you see that a little bit in the state, too. We had a continuing resolution. We had a veto of a budget in the early summer, and there was a lot of rhetoric in the summer that would suggest that this would be a big staying thing. But then there was a compromise. There was a three-month continuing resolution. And Sununu essentially said that he would agree to anything in the budget as long as it met his spending targets. And so they came out with a compromise. So now both sides have a win. And voters, I would argue, have probably completely forgotten anything that happened in the summer. So when you talk about the budget, it's a win for both sides, but it's not a win that is easily translatable into an attack on the other side. Sununu yesterday was talking up all the investments were made in the budget, and both sides were applauding. So I think when I say calm before the storm, when you're looking at the budget and from it through a political lens, there's no real way to attack the other side. But what's coming around the corner are a lot more heated social issues like guns, like voting laws that will likely produce more vetoes, more rancor, and more conflict heading into the summer. And so I think that's what everyone's kind of holding their powder right now and waiting until the inevitable happens. But for now, it's kind of a both sides win situation.
Anna, go ahead.
Yeah, kind of bouncing off that calm before the storm issue as well. The other thing that I think is worth noting about this year's budget compromise was it completely kicked the can on school funding, really. New Hampshire has lawsuits pending on that. There's a commission that was convened this year to study the issue yet again. This has been studied many times in the past. And that was going to be a big part of the Democrats' budget originally, you know, coming up with a new school funding formula. So they were able to compromise with Governor Sununu because he just kind of pushed that issue down the road. And so certainly next year coming up, that's gonna be a really hard debate because New Hampshire only has so much revenue and that system for funding is very much being challenged.
Well, in the speech yesterday, the governor said he was especially pleased with the budget's focus on education from elementary school all the way up to higher education. So let's hear that.
We've sent $62 million back to local school districts simply for school infrastructure projects. We've restored stabilization grants to school districts across the state. We've increased funding for full-day kindergarten. We fully funded the special education aid. We froze tuition at the university system and in our community colleges. We doubled our nursing programs at UNH, and we finally restarted the long-absent LPN nursing program within the community college system.
So there he is, Ethan, saying, hey, look, we invested in education.
Yeah, and he's right. These are all important priorities that were passed last year. And the way he kind of structured it, he had his own budget that he proposed last year before it moved along and the Democrats took control. So some of those priorities he was talking about, like infrastructure, were in his original budget. Some of them were Democratic priorities that he didn't put in his original budget but that were added in later. And I think it's just when you get to the end, it's just to my point earlier, once you have a negotiation and a compromise, kind of both sides can claim it. They both don't want the other two, and Democrats would argue, oh, he didn't put that in, and Sununu would argue, well, I put it in a responsible budget, and they didn't. But they've ultimately agreed on a budget in the end, so it's that succession of things you just said is something that I don't think any Democrat could not applaud for. This is all things that everybody wants.
And sure.
So, you know, it's almost like, you know, daring Democrats to politicize this. You know, we did this last year and, you know, see what you can do with this, because this is ultimately good for the state. And this is where we actually did come together. And I think you saw yesterday that they, you know, you can't politicize when you cooperate.
Sure. Dean,
go ahead. I think Anna's point is a very important one, this idea that education has been kicked down the road a little bit. You know, Governor Sununu was able to enumerate a number of what he views as successes on education, but that kind of obscures a deeper debate, I think, between the governor and the state legislature about how to fund public education in the state. And, you know, we've seen these various debates. The big one right now is over the millions of dollars in federal aid for charter schools that was declined. There is this fundamental philosophical debate on education between the administration and the state legislature about, you know, whether or not public schools are being neglected, and whether or not, you know, conservatives in the administration are trying to direct money to, you know, parochial schools and homeschooling rather than public education. So every time we talk about education, I always listen for that underlying philosophical debate that is still there, and I think making it very challenging for the two sides to agree.
A philosophical debate about where we put our dollars.
Yeah, and how much do you fund public education? Where do you put your dollars? Who should have access to that money?
All right. Well, thank you for the perfect segue, because we're going to talk about education after a break. Also, some of the bills that you all mentioned, in addition to education and charter schools, I want to ask you about water contamination. We had some local officials on the show yesterday who really want help cleaning up from what are called PFAS chemicals. Also, net metering. We'll have to take a minute to explain what that is and why that has just got so many people feeling passionate about that bill that was vetoed. We should also talk about guns. There are several bills, and make note of the fact that this is the second anniversary of the Parkland, Florida massacre. So that's kind of salient right now. So all that is coming up, and we welcome your questions and comments. Of course, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Thank you.
You're listening to NHPR Good Morning. And if you're looking to break up with your old car, truck, or motorcycle on this Valentine's Day, why not donate it to NHPR to support programming you adore, like The Exchange? All donations are tax deductible and scheduling a pickup is free. You can learn more at nhpr.org/car donation. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from New England College, hosting Vermont-based singer-songwriter Dave Richardson, February 22nd at 7:30 in Henniker. Information at nec.edu/community. And from Morno Law, located in Nashua, focusing on family law, estate planning, probate matters, and more, helping good people through tough times. Learn more at mornolaw.com. Partly to mostly sunny for today, windy, highs single digits in the northern part of the state, ranging to about 20 degrees in southern New Hampshire. You're listening to NHPR.
It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and this Friday we're calling it the What Else Was Happening in New Hampshire Besides Presidential Politics edition. We have been looking at the governor's State of the State address, some of the themes there. We're going to tackle now the many, many bills that lawmakers are making their way through. And a little bit later on in the hour, we will talk about some of the primary mop-up, if we could call it that. There's new numbers about turnout, also delegates. We'd love to hear from you, especially as we look at some of the major bills before the legislature right now. We're going to talk about net metering, charter schools, guns, and a few other issues, including water contamination. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Anna Brown with Citizens Count, Ethan DeWitt with Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis with SNHU. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. And Penty's calling from Pembroke. Hi, Penty. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I've got a bit of a cold, so I hope it works okay.
That's okay. Tis the season, Penty. Go ahead.
It is. the issue is net metering. The governor has proposed a plan that primarily serves to restrict the development of distributed generation. The older system, the one that had bipartisan support, allowed for the growth of the system to 5 megawatts. The issue here is the governor's argument is that this is really expensive. And in fact, the way that the current regulation is for larger stuff, there is no cost transfer at all. In fact, it ends up that the distributed generator is subsidizing the utility for services it did not provide. The effect is exactly the same as if I turn the lights out when I leave the room, the utility doesn't get that revenue.
Well, Penty, I'm so glad you called because we've done whole shows on net metering. We won't do that now, but Ethan, just give us a sort of super short explanation of what net metering is for folks who don't know.
Sure. So net metering is the ability for those who produce renewable power, for instance, through solar panels in their homes or in their businesses, to sell excess power back into the grid. And what makes it net metering and the key is how much what price you get when you get that back. So if you get the default energy, default service rate, you can get up to 8 to 9 cents.
So you make a little money off of those solar panels.
Yes, and the idea is that it encourages more people to install these and also businesses to expand the ones they have. Democrats have been pushing for a while. Right now the cap is on a generator of 1 megawatt. If your generator is above 1 megawatt, you can't actually sell back at those higher rates. And so there is a disincentive to get a larger generator. They'd like to raise it to 5 megawatts. Sununu vetoed a bill that would do that. He vetoed one last year. He also vetoed one this week. And Democrats keep coming up with kind of new proposals. Sununu's argument is that by doing that, the utility companies are going to shift costs onto ratepayers that might come out of having to purchase this power. He's come out with estimates of tens of millions of dollars that would be shifted on, but there hasn't actually been any estimate given by the Public Utilities Commission that backs that up. So it's kind of hard. Everybody's sort of working in the dark here on what the impact would be.
Well, and it's interesting, too. We did a whole show on sort of larger solar projects, and it's not just the homeowner with, you know, a couple solar panels on their roof. It's cities and towns and big businesses who want to put up solar panels. Mm-hmm. And perhaps other alternative forms of energy, and you know, make some real money from that.
Yeah, and so you've had cities...
or at least benefit from energy savings.
Yeah, and it's not just solar, it's hydro as well. We've had cities like Nashua lobbying to do that so that cities can take advantage of this. I would say, speaking earlier to the themes of having kind of parallel bills going forward this year, this is one where the governor, as the caller noted, has submitted his own version of a plan for net metering. It's a lot more modest. And one thing that would kind of illustrate that is for those generators who are over one, if it would expand it up, but the payout rate for those larger generators would be half the rate of what the Democrats are proposing. So Democrats are proposing 8 or 9 cents. If you had a bigger generator under the governor's plan, it would actually be between 3.9 and 4 cents. So in order to make money, because you'd be losing money in the short term, you'd have to have a much bigger generator to make up for that loss.
So everybody wants net metering. It's just a matter of the numbers, Dean. That's what it sounds
like. Just stepping back a moment to take a look at the bigger picture here. You know, when we had Governor Hassan, before Governor Sununu was elected to office, like a lot of Democrats, her focus was on percent renewable energy, this sort of move to increasingly use renewables and phase out fossil fuels. And so all the debates surrounded that, and that kind of led into the climate change debate, et cetera. When Governor Sununu came in, he said, well, you know, renewables are important, but I'm going to focus on the cost of electricity to consumers. And whatever mix gets us to a more affordable electric rate, that's what I'm going to do. And now he has opposed drilling off the coast of New Hampshire and other issues, and he's not opposed to renewables. But the debate now over energy policy is just feels fundamentally different than what we felt during the Hassan administration, even going back to John Lynch. And it is this idea that you, rather than make the objective of policy percent renewables, the objective of policy is to get electric prices, which are high, to drop. And so it's a fundamentally different debate that has room for things like natural gas and other types of products as well.
So correct me if I'm wrong, Anna, though, it does seem like there's been some movement on this, kind of what Ethan said. People, Democrats and Republicans, on many of these issues are saying, yes, we want to do something on this. We just differ about how we get there. But it sounds like they're at least getting there.
Absolutely. I definitely think that there is potential on this for Democrats and Republicans, particularly Governor Sununu, to come together, because Democrats and Republicans are already coming together with it on the legislature. I think that really the point is where they can find a meeting point with Governor Sununu. And as Ethan noted, the real issue here is that there's just a lot of questions about what these impacts would be. And so Governor Sununu is just taking a very sort of careful, conservative position on this. But he does recognize that this is potentially a very good idea that could, in particular, help towns and cities that are also struggling to, you know, pay their bills.
Sure.
To Dean's point, just the since the governor is so focused on bringing down rates, right, that, you know, any new transition to new energy sources, there's always uncertainty. And so I think that is the a fallback argument that can be continually made by the governor, which is that we have a system now. Why don't we use these sources and not take such a huge leap where we don't know what the unknown is. Proponents of clean energy would say that, you know, we need to take these steps now and the benefits will follow. But it's just, you know,
that's the debate. Yeah.
Right. That's the debate. That's the
well, point. I want to talk about a bunch of other bills that are making their way through the legislature. So, Penty, thank you for raising that one, because we did need to cover that. I also want to talk about gun bills, also efforts to lower prescription drug costs, charter schools, which you mentioned earlier, Dean Spiliotis, and family leave, which is another one of those issues where everybody says they want it. They just have different paths to get there. So, Exchange listeners, if you want to join us on those topics or other bills of interest to you, we'd love to hear from you. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, Twitter. You can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So Chris wrote us from Concord, who says, as the sponsor of the $15 minimum wage bill, I'm glad it passed the House. The governor has said almost verbatim that he would not do anything stupid like pass a New Hampshire minimum wage, calling us, quote, political, and says he will veto any rate we send him. The governor has been unwilling to work with us, and he has the extreme view. This is State Representative Chris Schultz, by the way, from Concord. Chris says even a majority of New Hampshire GOP voters want a minimum wage of $12 or $15 an hour. All of the Democrats would have sought a wage rate of $8 an hour or $9 or $10 if he would sign it, but since he wanted none, we decided to go for this, the plan our congressional representatives passed in the U.S. House. Chris says the governor has been beyond obstinate and unhelpful at the expense of low-wage Granite Staters. Wow, Chris, thank you for calling. $15 minimum wage, Anna.
So the interesting thing about the minimum wage was there was a time before he was governor when Chris Nunu said, I would be open to a minimum wage increase, probably at the federal level as opposed to the state level. But
because New Hampshire's is tied to the federal minimum.
It is. So we're just defaulted at the federal rate. And so he was saying this is probably a federal issue, but it wasn't that he didn't seem so, you know, diametrically opposed to it. And now it does seem it doesn't matter what the increase is, he's going to veto it. And so Democrats have put forward, there's a bill in the House, as the Chris noted. There's also a bill in the Senate that gradually raises the wage to $12. And so I think that ultimately for Democrats, yeah, they know they're going to get a veto. The governor doesn't seem like he's going to move on this. But on the other hand, New Hampshire did elect Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, and minimum wage was one of the big issues that most of those Democrats are running on. So I think for them, they're saying, you know what, we're going to deliver what we were elected, what our platform was.
Well, and Dean, the argument, though, is that, look, most people don't make minimum wage anyway here in New Hampshire. You know, most people make $9 or $10 anyway. The labor market is so tight. People can't get away with paying this anyway, so why bother? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the minimum wage has become a key litmus test between Republicans and Democrats electorally. I recall, and I've mentioned this a number of times on the show, that you and I were in the studio the morning after the 2018 election, and you had Governor Sununu on, and you asked him, would you support raising the minimum wage? And he literally said, now, why would I do that? You could just tell by the tone that it is not going to happen. And the argument, it's an article of faith among Republicans that if you raise the minimum wage, you put upward pressure on all wages, which makes small business owners have to pay wages that they can't afford, and they inevitably go out of business. So,
and they're concerned about
inflationary pressures. Absolutely. I don't see anywhere where we're going to get agreement on this. It's going to be an election issue. I guess in theory, if they could get enough Republican support, they might be able to override a veto. But this is just one of those articles of faith, a litmus test for Republicans. It's just I don't see any way that it will happen here with him.
You know, Ethan, you've talked about how on many of these issues, Republicans and Democrats are trying to find compromises. You mentioned net metering, you know, kind of messing around with the numbers. Which rate do we agree on? What about with minimum wage? Our emailer, Chris, says, look, we're willing to go with 10 or 12. Is there a middle lane on this?
It sounded like the point she was making. Beyond that, just kind of what you've seen, there is a split between the Senate and the House on this, and it is a difference in how to move forward. The House, Sununu has already vetoed a $12 minimum wage bill. And so with that landscape, there's a bunch of ways you can proceed. It seems like the House has decided, well, if he's already vetoed that, we might as well go for what we want, which is 15, and make it a values debate where we can actually and you know that it'll likely be vetoed. Mm-hmm. The Senate is taking a different tack. Senate President Donna Susie has been pushing for the minimum wage for a while, but she's pushing for 12. And kind of what I hear is that some Senate Democrats are sort of balking at the idea of 15 because they want to hold on to the idea that they could still get a breakthrough with the governor.
So find that middle lane. Yeah, is it 12? Is it 11?
Between the chambers, it's kind of two you know, distinct ways to go about it. And it kind of comes down to whether you think that you may be able to make an argument to the governor in an election year to get something, or whether you'd rather make kind of take a bigger stand on this issue. One thing I just want to add about the minimum wage is that I think, you know, over the decades, we've seen its role, I think, in the way it's kind of been talked about, especially on the Republican side, differ. I think where before it was sort of seen as a way to actually provide an income, it's now been argued by on the floor frequently by Republicans as not a wage that anybody should live on and not meant to be a wage that anyone should live on, but really just a backstop against anybody getting absolutely abhorrent wages. And the idea is it's just something to set higher wages too. And one, you know, it's been over 10 years. I think it was 2009 the last time New Hampshire raised its minimum wage. If you look at inflation, that minimum wage used to be about $11 an hour when it was passed. $11 in today's terms would have been the minimum wage in New Hampshire 10 years ago. Every year that's dropped down, and now it's in today's terms, you know, it's $7.25. But $7.25 10 years ago just meant more.
And I see what you're saying. Uh-huh.
So the minimum wage is dropping just in real terms.
In terms of purchasing power.
Yes. And yeah. So now you're seeing a shift in philosophy around the minimum wage to this is not actually meant to be something you can live off. This is meant to be just, like I said, a backstop.
Okay. And, you know. Well, Chris, thank you for the email. And a couple other bills I want to ask all of you about. Gun bills, prescription drug costs, charter schools, family leave. Hopefully we can get through all of that. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, and our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Dan is calling in from Concord. Welcome, Dan. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Speaking of guns, HB 1115, which I oppose, and I'm a lifelong hunter and gun owner, not opposed to common sense gun laws, by the way, but this one would change the distance from which you could discharge a firearm from 300 feet, which is what it's always been, to 900 feet. It stemmed from some southern New Hampshire residents being annoyed by people target practicing with high-powered rifles. Now, if you look on the Fish and Game website, all of the towns virtually south and east of the Hooks Atolls already have restrictions in place banning the use of high-powered centerfire rifles. So it's unnecessary because there were already laws in place that they could have used to go after these people. And two, based on the highly urbanized environment, it would effectively ban all hunting south and east of the Hooks Atolls.
Because 900 feet is just too far to get a deer? Is that what you're saying, Dan?
Yeah. Because there's so many housing developments, and they also changed the language to allow to ban use of firearms even when there's not a house present if it's an area where public congregate, like at a trailhead parking area. And it would basically, Fish and Game is the public agency that's charged with managing wildlife. It would essentially make it impossible for Fish and Game to do their job.
Dan, I'm glad you called, and I did want to talk about this whole suite of gun bills, but could I ask you, as a hunter and gun owner, you said you do favor, quote, common sense gun laws, and boy, this is a term that's thrown around a lot lately, Dan. I wonder what that means to you.
I would be in favor of increased mental health background checks. I'm not opposed necessarily to a 3-day waiting period. I mean, I don't think anyone who wakes up in the morning and says, I need a gun today, probably doesn't need a gun today. And I have lots of gun friends who hunt and own guns that feel the same way. I mean, I think a majority of gun owners favor things like that. Red flag laws, I'm not opposed to. I think this one, though, specifically because there are already town ordinances in most of these towns that ban, you know, I think hunters are going to suffer because of the actions of a few people who are already violating laws and who probably would violate this law too if it were in place.
Well, Dan, it's really good to hear from you. Thank you very much for calling in today. And I did want to talk about gun laws because, A, there's a lot in the legislature, and I'm going to turn to you first, but anyone jump in. And B, makes my stomach hurt to say this. This is the second anniversary of the Parkland shooting, which took so many beautiful lives, young lives, and teachers as well. So hurts to even talk about it. But let's talk about some of the bills before the legislature. Dan gave his take on this 300 feet versus 900 feet. Says there's already ordinances in place that can deal with some of these problems. But he did say he supports so-called red flag laws. And just remind our audience, Anna, what those are.
Sure. So a red flag law is basically a law that would allow someone to get sort of similar to a restraining order process. They'd be able to go to law enforcement, go to the courts, and put an order in place to have firearms confiscated from someone who was found to pose an extreme risk to themselves or others. And so the New Hampshire House did in January pass HB 687 to establish quote-unquote extreme risk protection orders.
That's what they're called. Sort of sounds like a domestic violence restraining order. But
exactly.
That's
like
the
I
language.
Said, there's little bits of similarities in those processes.
Sure,
and
go
so
ahead.
There's concern about, you know, false accusations, people basically having their firearms confiscated, not getting be able to get them back, and, you know, also accusations that, okay, it would remove firearms in emergency, but what about underlying issues of getting this person services if they are suicidal, if they do have mental health issues, and that is not really addressed in the bill. So that bill did go through, but there's also a bevy of other gun bills that are coming up. Waiting period, allowing towns to set stricter noise ordinances, there's ratings to shooting ranges. The red flag law I mentioned, So there's just a magazine size, whether or not you can sue gun companies, a whole bunch.
Wow. Okay. Well, maybe we'll pick up on that after a short break. And we really should talk about prescription drug costs. That is a big focus of lawmakers at the state and national level. So we'll do that coming up, and we'll keep hearing from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Dan, thank you for joining us with that call. You can give us a call, too, at 800-892-6477.
It ain't over yet.
98% of people still haven't been heard from. This is going to be a long primary process.
Primaries, judicial politics, and a post-impeachment purge. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's time to catch up on a big and busy week. It's the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
That's This Morning at 10 here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners and from Franklin Pierce University, offering master's degrees online with flexible schedules and 4 terms per year. Learn more at franklinpierce.edu. And from Second Wind Water Systems, specializing in treating New Hampshire's water quality problems and providing clean and safe water for over 30 years. Information at secondwindwater.com. Partly to mostly sunny and windy for today. High temperatures, single digits in northern parts of the state, ranging to around 20 degrees in southern New Hampshire.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, the what else was happening in the Granite State besides presidential politics edition. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. As we catch up on some of the many bills before the legislature, we've been talking about net metering concerning alternative energy. We've also covered gun bills. We've talked about the minimum wage. I do want to turn to prescription drug costs, charter schools, and family leave. Can we get through that in the next 15 minutes? We'll see, guys. But I wonder, Dean, if you wanted to just weigh in on what Anna was saying about this whole slew of gun bills that we're seeing before the legislature.
Yeah, this is, you know, this is another one of those, increasingly so, even with the tragedy that you mentioned, that we can think of a lot of other ones as well, Parkland and other places. This has become one of those litmus tests about Second Amendment rights and individual liberty. And it's the type of thing where Anna or Ethan may have a better sense of how likely Governor Sununu is to cooperate on any of these. But this has been one of those issues where there's just sort of philosophical differences about the right to bear arms and how that bumps up against public safety and community versus individual rights. So, we've watched a lot of these come through in the last few years, the state legislature, and it's just been incredibly difficult to get agreement on anything. There are some, you know, very powerful, the NRA and other organizations that are very focused on blocking these kinds of pieces of legislation. So I don't really have a good sense of how likely any of this is to come to fruition. But even the typical fallback for most conservatives or Republicans is, well, from a mental health perspective, we're willing to discuss it, but that's a separate issue from the right to carry and how you use your gun, et cetera.
Well, we will do whole shows on this as the year and the legislative session rolls out for sure. I'm going to set that aside for now, even though there's a whole lot more we could talk about. And Ethan, I wanted to ask you about prescription drug costs. This is something I hear members of Congress and members of our legislature focusing on. So what are they saying? What are they hoping to do?
Sure. So this is something that actually has the support of the governor and his prime opponents, Senator Dan Feltes. There's a bill, one particular bill that would allow wholesale importation from Canada. And this is something that's often talked about in Washington. Other states have tried it. Vermont and Maine, I believe, have programs right now. And the argument is just a simple cost saver for the state to kind of be able to have a new source that doesn't, that kind of goes beyond the prescription drug market of the U.S., which can be incentivized to be much higher priced than necessarily needs to be.
So when you say wholesale importation, what does that mean, Ethan? Does that mean sort of any drug you want, or you get the wholesale price, or what does that mean?
I'm not entirely too familiar with this bill, to be very honest. But I would imagine that as it would mean some sort of negotiated price with the state acting as kind of a...
I see, an arbiter to make sure that it's these drugs. One concern that comes up is, are these drugs really what they say they are? They're coming in the mail. Do you really know? Did they come from Canada or did they come from, you know, some other country? Like India, I heard, has been getting involved in sort of making drugs this way.
So one of the big reasons why Canadian drugs are cheaper is because Canada has a health system where they're negotiating, the government negotiates directly with prescription drug companies and sets the price for everyone in Canada. And since they're doing it for everyone in Canada, they have a lot more negotiating power. But that means that also they're able to get those lower prices. So theoretically, if we bought, as New Hampshire, as a state, bought drugs from Canada, we could be getting those lower prices. The problem is that it doesn't really guarantee lower costs because federal law prohibits the importation of biologic drugs such as insulin. And that, of course, is one drug that we know has been a big issue in terms of those high costs. And Canadian officials are actually against this idea because they believe that it could lead to drug shortages in Canada, which is then going to drive up the price there. So it's one of those, kind of like we were talking about, you know, net metering and renewable energy. This is another one of those ideas that's a new idea that, okay, the prices are lower up there. It'd be great if we could get in on that. But will that actually materialize once a program gets going? Yeah. That's not so sure.
There has been efforts in D.C., and I believe our Congresswoman Annie Custer is championing one of them, to kind of, and you've heard it on the debate stage, too, in 2020, to negotiate drug prices through Medicaid and Medicare. And that's sort of essentially what Canada has already done. And so this is kind of like a way to take advantage of another country's doing something that some people want to do in the U.S. if the you know, one of the biggest payers in the country, you know, Medicare, were able to negotiate these prices, we could have something similar without relying on Canada. And I think that's what you did hear from some of the trade groups from Canada who are not too excited about another state jumping in.
Right, a huge state, entity, the United States. And that's what I don't really get about this, Dean. And mm-hmm. I keep saying this, but I think this is a whole long hour discussion. Yeah. But, you know, kind of picking up on what Ethan and Anna said, Canada has these lower prices because they have a different political system and a different type of policy concerning drugs. So this sort of let's import their drugs but not their policies. Yeah, it kind of how sustainable is that really?
It's very complex.
I mean, pardon the pun, it's kind of a Band-Aid, isn't it?
Absolutely. As you said, we could do an entire show on it. It's very complex. It's a very potent electoral issue, particularly you hear a lot of politicians bringing up many of the anecdotal stories we hear about people having to decide whether to buy insulin or buy food and sharing medications, et cetera. It's been a big problem for a while now. And the sort of two issues, one issue is just the strength of the pharmaceutical lobby, both nationally and at the state level. So that's part of the issue. And then the second issue is just figuring out, who's going to make the first move. Our state's going to say federal government's not acting on this. We need to take action. Or is it incumbent upon the federal government to make some changes first and then coordinate with the state level? But it's one of those things we're going to hear in every campaign speech. There are lots of very heartbreaking anecdotes out there, but it's so complex and so heavily lobbied politically that it's just going to be difficult, I think, to move forward. But there's, again, I think it's a great way to say there's a consensus that it's a great idea, but the devil is always in the details.
And there's a need. I should point out that this is according to testimony from Senator Feltes and from the governor, that in 2017, about 22% of Granite Staters reportedly stopped taking their prescriptions because they were unable to afford them. And in the meantime, costs have been rising, apparently about 60% in the state of New Hampshire between 2017 and 2012 and 2017. So over 5 years, a 60% increase.
That's huge.
Most older adults take between 4 and 5 types of prescription drugs.
Sure.
So this is just, it's a growing problem. And I think no matter how it shakes out, I think, and how feasible it is long term, this is kind of seen to be a step that the state can take, whatever happens in Washington, for right. now just until there's something better in place.
Anna, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple of the other ideas. So Canadian imports, that was one he testified in favor of. The same day, he also testified in favor of a bill that would prevent insurance companies from changing their drug coverage in the middle of a plan year, and another one that would create a board in New Hampshire to basically monitor the changes in cost in prescription drugs. Meanwhile, there are other bills that would, for example, just cap the price of insulin. And bills such as that, once again, I would argue kind of a stopgap measure, because the idea is then health insurance companies are going to say, all right, well, if this is what you're going to let us charge, then we're going to have to cover those costs in other parts of our premiums. So those are just some of the other ideas floating out.
All right, let's take another call. And this is Red in Nashua. Hi, Red. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine.
It's actually Fred.
Fred, I apologize.
Nope, that's fine. My point was with regard to the slew of gun laws that are up as proposals. It just ethically or philosophically, it seems to me, if somebody screams fire in a crowded movie theater, everybody else doesn't lose their First Amendment rights. So I'm a little bit wary of that. And I have no problem with, you know, closing the gun hole or the gun show loopholes and whatnot, so that criminals aren't getting their hands on guns. The other thing is, we have a whole bunch of legal ways to prevent people who are violent or have lost their right as a result of committing a crime to actually go after these people. What we don't have are the resources and money allocated to that. So effectively writing any more laws, it seems a moot point until you can enforce the current ones, as Dan said.
Well, Fred, I'm really glad you called, and we're definitely going to follow up with a whole show on gun laws. And Dean, this is very quickly, and then I do want to move on to charter schools. Yeah. This is a point that some people make, that, you know, we've got reasonable laws on the books, we just don't have the resources to carry them out.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You hear that fairly frequently. And, you know, the issue is that that so much of the gun debate revolves around and is in tandem with these big tragedies like Parkland or Sandy Hook. And, you know, both sides kind of fall back into their positions that, you know, the Democrats want to have more regulations on guns and Second Amendment. And Republicans say, well, it's not about the guns. It's about mental health and other kinds of issues in society that lead to this sort of violence. So, as I said, it has shaped up in recent years to be a litmus test between the two parties. And even small changes in regulations have just been very difficult to get through. But you certainly can make the argument that, you know, in more resources to enforce what's already on the books is part of that debate.
Fred, I appreciate the call. Thank you for being with us. And I did want to ask about charter schools, because, Ethan, I know we need to let you go a little early today because you're running to a hearing. So what is happening with charter schools in the legislature?
Okay, well,
where to begin?
Yeah, so there is a large federal grant to New Hampshire. It was the largest in the country. They and this was to expand charter schools.
$46 million.
$46 million. Yeah, and so New Hampshire had lobbied for this, and I believe it would have added an additional 27 or 28 charter schools according to the plan that the Department of Education put forward. We right now have about 27. So it would roughly double under their plan.
I didn't know we had that many.
Yeah. And it would roughly double them, the number of charter schools across the state. The way these grants work is when we get big grants from the federal government, they have to be approved by the legislature. We don't just get them. And there's a panel called the Fiscal Committee, which is meeting in 9 minutes, which is a joint panel between the House and the Senate that kind of makes these approvals for these big appropriations. They usually approve them. You know, anything federal money that doesn't affect the state budget usually gets through without a problem. In this case, Democrats pointed to concerns that they had with expanding charter schools so rapidly, and kind of pointed to what they said would be costs that could be put onto traditional public schools that are, you know, neighborhood schools where they have to, you know, both schools are public, but neighborhood schools have to serve, you know, all students in their area. Charter schools can be more selective, and that this would kind of essentially pull resources away. Republicans have argued that's overblown. And what's happened is the Democrats have struck down the first tranche of this $46 million. It was like $46 million over 5 years.
I see.
So the first 10 or 11 million was struck down last year, and that created a partisan furor. And now you have the Department of Education coming back today. It's the third time, I believe, that Department of Education Commissioner Frank Edelblut has returned with this pitch. This time he's armed with a study that the department has done that suggests that New Hampshire could save money instead of lose money or have to spend money on these charter schools. So we'll see how that plays out today. But it looks like Democrats are digging in their heels on this issue. They would like to direct the conversation back to the study commission that Anna noted at the top of the program that is looking at you know, how to improve the system and the reimbursement for the public schools that we have now.
Wow, really interesting. Well, we will let you go a couple minutes early. We don't want you to be late for sure. Commissioner Edelblut's opening statement. Ethan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for
we
having
sure appreciate
me.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Ethan DeWitt, again, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor, dashing off to the State House right now. But Anna and Dean, you're stuck with me for a couple more minutes. So, Dean, big news this week. Again, we've been talking about other news besides the presidential primary. But as of today, what other sort of numbers or facts have emerged now that the candidates and the activists have packed up and left town, yeah, along with the national media, by the
sure,
way.
Sure, absolutely. The circus has left town,
right,
as they say. Well, you know, I think what you've heard mainly is a giant sigh of relief that everything went as smoothly as Secretary Gardner had hoped. You got a standing ovation at the State of the State address. I think in given what's happened in Iowa and now how that has thrown the whole Iowa caucus future into question, I think people are relieved that it went really smoothly. Record turnout, Democrats, over 300,000 people turned out. The previous record with President Obama in 2008 was about 287,000.
Now that's
interesting. That's important to show. The concern was that the turnout in Iowa was flat. And so the national party was concerned that there wasn't enough enthusiasm, and we certainly showed here in the state that there is a lot of enthusiasm for voting. And I think President Trump got a record number of votes in the Republican primary, even though an incumbent you typically don't have a huge turnout. So close to 450,000 people voted in the primary, which is for a state of 1.3 million. That's a phenomenal.
That's great to
phenomenal
hear
turnout.
That it went well.
Yeah,
and that
it's getting great reviews
there
around the country. You know, it may not save us from the debate that's brewing about diversity and whether or not we should be the first primary.
But at least we know
we put
what
our
we're
best
doing
foot forward. Yes, absolutely. No one came away saying that we shouldn't do it because of logistical reasons or lack of enthusiasm. The other thing I will mention is the Sanders Buttigieg margin, 1.3%. That is perhaps the closest, I think, in modern primary in history here in terms of a finish, if not one of the closest, if not the closest. And that's remarkable.
And
1.3%.
Stunning, given that, you know, Bernie Sanders has been on the national stage for 3 decades and Pete Buttigieg, no one could pronounce his name 6 months ago.
Yep.
So Governor Sununu did give a big cheer during his State of the State address. You know, job well done for everyone. Let's just hear a little bit of that.
And it isn't the governor or the legislature or political parties that dealt that successful primary, but our city and town officials, our moderators, the clerks, the supervisors of the checklist, and the hundreds of Granite Staters that volunteer their time to help out on primary day. And most importantly and especially, Secretary of State Bill Gardner, Dave Scanlon, we say thank you, thank you, thank you, sir. Great job by the entire team.
Again, that's Governor Sununu at a State of the State, leading a cheer for a successful New Hampshire primary. Anna Brown, switching back to the legislature, what are you going to be looking at in the coming week?
Well, there's one debate that I feel hasn't been getting a ton of press, but me and my political wonk hat,
let's
I've been
it
following a lot. And so it's the concept of a road usage fee.
Oh, we should talk about that.
Yes. So the idea is very short terms. You know, basically you pay for based on mileage or how many miles you travel, so that electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, pay more since they're paying less with the gas tax. So the House voted down one yesterday, even though it had a bipartisan committee recommendation in favor. Next week, a slightly different version of that is coming up again in the House, so I'll be watching that.
All right. And Dean Spiliotis, I'm guessing you're keeping an eye on Nevada.
Yeah, Nevada.
Nevada,
as I like to say,
me,
they get very angry if you say Nevada. Nevada, there's a debate coming up Wednesday night in Nevada, which is going to be interesting. I'm also looking at kind of the ripples of our primary, the ripple effect, and seeing how the state party is now going to prep for a defense of our status in the next cycle. That debate's already starting up. And finally, just looking at the Democratic response here to the State of the State address to try to get some insight into what their strategy is going to be going into November.
Okay, well, and again, now that the circus has left town, as you said, Dean, yep. You both have whetted my appetite for a lot more shows we can look at. Road usage fees, guns, prescription drugs, net metering, and so on. Thank you both very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
And you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.
NHPR's Civics 101 has an annual student contest, and this year we asked for stump speeches. What are the biggest issues facing the country right now, and how would students solve them?
Corporations should not get away with making a profit at the expense of our planet.
Now is the future, and we need to start investing in it.
How is it fair that men get paid more money than women for doing the same job?
You can hear all of our contest winners on our latest episode. Download it at civics101podcast.org or on your favorite podcast app.
Support for NHPR comes from your listeners and from Bank of New Hampshire, offering a full line of small business products to streamline banking while providing increased flexibility to focus on a growing business. BankNH.com. And from Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, providing flexible health plans for any budget to communities across New Hampshire. Get healthy, get happy. Learn more at GetHarvardPilgrim.com. Partly to mostly sunny for today, windy with high temperatures single digits in northern parts of the state ranging to around 20 degrees in southern New Hampshire. You're listening to NHPR.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at NHPR.com.